From Silver Hollow Audio and Radio Catskill, this is Cats Cast. I'm Brett Barry, and each week we bring you stories and conversations rooted right here in our mountains and valleys. Local culture, history, sustainability, nature, literature, and the arts, and lots more. Coming up, the Blue Butterfly Foundation is based in the Hudson Valley with a mission to help impoverished children in Nepal. We are joined by founder Lauren Yanks and two young beneficiaries of the program, now enrolled at SUNY New Paltz.
Then one day he told me that, you know, I have met this woman. She's so amazing. She takes me to these amazing places and, you know, buys me the chocolates and stuff. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. Like, you know, I want that too. And do you think I can also meet that woman? And he was like, let me think about it.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. President Trump has removed tariffs on a list of items, including several groceries, reversing some of his sweeping import taxes. This after Democrats won big in last week's elections on platforms focused on affordability. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has more.
The long list of items that tariffs will be removed from includes foods like fruits and vegetables, beef, and coffee. American importers paid those tariffs, with many passing costs on to U.S. consumers. Removing these tariffs could therefore lower the higher prices the tariffs caused. The tariffs that will be removed are the sweeping country-by-country tariffs Trump first introduced in April, calling them reciprocal tariffs. Recent polls have shown Americans' approval of Trump on the economy, typically a strong issue for him, has slipped. Consumer confidence has also declined. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
A senior administration official tells NPR Trump will soon travel around the country with a message. While some things have improved, there is more work to do to help people feeling economic strain. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein is urging calm ahead of the expected arrival of Border Patrol agents in Charlotte as soon as this weekend. A demonstration is planned this afternoon. As Nick De La Canal from member station WFAE reports, some immigrant businesses are already feeling the impact.
Inside a Latin bakery on Charlotte's east side, workers say business has dropped sharply. Owner Manolo Bentacor says news that Border Patrol agents are coming has driven people indoors.
No, everybody's hidden, man. Nobody's coming out.
His parking lot was empty during what's usually prime time, and the bakery's already had a tough year.
Easy. We can make 50 quinceañera cakes between spring and summer. This year, we just have one quinceañera.
Border Patrol agents are expected this weekend or early next week. Governor Stein is urging residents to not be provoked and to record any inappropriate behavior by agents with their phones. For NPR News, I'm Nick Della Canal in Charlotte.
It was a mixed week for the stock market. NPR's Scott Horsley reports relief at the end of the government shutdown was tempered by concerns that tech stocks might be overvalued.
The six-week government shutdown was a drag on the U.S. economy. The White House estimates it shaved about $90 billion off of fourth-quarter GDP. Some of that will be made up now that the government's reopened, but some of the loss will be permanent. We'll also get a better handle on the economy once the government number crunchers who were idled by the shutdown start churning out reports again. We'll get a report on the September job market next Thursday, almost 7 weeks behind schedule. Tech stocks lost ground during the week as investors worried the artificial intelligence boom may be overdone. The tech-heavy NASDAQ slipped about 0.5%, while the S&P 500 index rose about 0.1%, and the Dow climbed more than 0.3%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York has agreed to delay implementation of the All-Electric Buildings Act. Here's Philip Pantuso of the Times Union.
This was a law that was scheduled to take effect in January that would basically ban gas hookups for all new buildings that are 7 stories or shorter, and then that would phase into all other new buildings by 2029 with very few exceptions. It is a key component of New York's climate goals, basically. And we discovered, our Capitol team, this week that the state has basically agreed to delay implementing that law, the All-Electric Buildings Act, pending an appeals court ruling, which is expected to come probably early next year. So a series of trade groups and labor unions sued to try to block this law 2 years ago, and they have not been successful so far, but they have appealed it up and it's now in the Second Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, which has not put it on the docket yet, but has set a deadline for filings for late December. So rather than just implement the law and let the court case play out, the state decided to delay implementing it pending the outcome of that decision. This drew a lot of criticism from environmental advocates who basically say, who essentially blamed the governor for using this case as cover to delay this law. You know, they've often criticized Kathy Hochul for being a little too cozy with developers and the real estate lobby. It's going to, I think, make New York fall even further behind its climate goals than it already is.
This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from The Economist. In a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR. This is NPR.
Welcome to Cat's Cast. This is Brett Barry, and I'm here with Lauren Yanks, founder and executive director of the Blue Butterfly Foundation, and also Kamlesh Baral and Sanjay Basnet, who are here because of the Blue Butterfly Foundation. So welcome, everybody, to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. We're so happy to be here.
Lauren, let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
You're the founder and executive director of this foundation, and you're based regionally here in Tilson, New York, which is in Ulster County?
Yes, but we actually live in New Paltz right now, so the boys can walk back and forth to school here.
And I think in order to know the Blue Butterfly Foundation, we need to start with the mission of the organization, which is to honor the memory of Zoe Damon, by helping children in need, including providing a loving home with nutritious food, proper shelter, and a high-quality education that will help break the cycles of poverty. Much of the work focuses on educating victims of trafficking and enslavement. That comes off your website. Tell me about Zoe.
That's devastating. Zoe was my stepdaughter. I loved her very much. I had been doing this work in Nepal, traveling there, starting in 2008, working with these children who'd been trafficked. And Zoe, I would come back and tell Zoe all about it. She, was very interested in service herself, and she was, a wonderful student, and going to SUNY Binghamton and studying biology. I adored her, and we had decided that she was going to come with me on my next trip to Nepal, that she was finally old enough in 2011. She went for a trip through SUNY Binghamton to study environmental sustainability in Costa Rica for the month of July 2011. She was a month shy of her 21st birthday. And one morning on July 15th, 2011, she was helping out, working in the rainforest, and there was a blue butterfly, one of those magical blue butterflies in Costa Rica that was following her around everywhere. And all the friends heard there, they all laughed about it and said how weird it was. And then on the way back from the rainforest that day, the professor was driving the van, and he pulled the van over to let another car go by, and the ground beneath the van gave way, and it fell down 100 feet and landed upside down in a shallow river. And all the other kids and the professor were able to get themselves out, but Zoe was stuck and drowned. Mm. And my husband and I were away at the time, and when we got the news, it breaks you, and it's a pain and a loss that really there's no words to describe it.
I'm so sorry. Thank you for telling us about her.
And she loved art, and she was full of life, and she was a great student, and she had beautiful red hair. And the first time I met her, I thought she was just a little girl. She was the cutest little thing I ever saw. So, yes, I hope I'm doing her justice.
And so you had been going to Nepal before
yes. this tragedy.
Yes.
You are a professor and a writer, and you've always had an interest in the issue of children's rights. You first traveled to Nepal in 2008 to write about young girls trafficked into sex slavery.
Yes.
The foundation came afterwards. The foundation came kind of out of the tragedy of Zoe, of Zoe's death.
Yes. So I went in 2008. Nepal specifically has a problem. It's this little landlocked country between two industrial rising giants of China and India, and has an open border with India. So many traffickers come and prey on this very poor country. They go into the villages and offer $52 for their daughters and say they'll go work in the factories and live a good life in Mumbai, etc. And then they're trafficked sometimes into these horrible slave-like factory conditions, but oftentimes into these brothels. The average age of a girl who's trafficked into the sex slavery around the world is 12 years old, but in South Asia, it's usually younger. And so I went there to, I had been reading a lot about it and I wanted to find out for myself. So one summer I had been teaching at SUNY New Paltz. I'd been teaching literature and writing because I also have an MFA in writing from NYU. And I went to go write about it and then to educate. And I fell in love with the country and the people. And when you go into these brothels and you see these little girls and the situation, it changes your DNA and you're never the same. And it became my calling. And yes.
What did you know about this situation before you went for this article? Had you been there before, or was this a new discovery for you? And who was that article for in 2008? Do you remember?
I think I was writing it for USA Today. I was writing for Gannett newspapers. But really it was for me, because I was always very interested in human rights and children's rights. And I felt like I wanted to get more involved. I love teaching and I love writing about things around here, etc. But I really felt it was time for me to get deeper, more on the ground in the things that really mattered in my heart. And I was nervous. I was very nervous about going. I didn't know much about it. I really just started reading about it in depth and was felt called to go find out more. So it was such a deep experience, so profound and overwhelming, and it really is almost like another planet landing in Nepal for the first time. And then to do that and to see the beautiful parts, but then to also see this dark side was life-changing, devastating, etc.
Sanjay and Kamlesh, can you tell me as much as you are able or willing what it was like for you growing up in Nepal? What was the situation for you? We'll start with Sanjay.
Well, I was born in India, mm-hmm. where my parents were slaves. I will start with the story of my dad. He grew up in a poor family in Nepal. When he was 12 years old, he had an opportunity where he can get a little money. A man came up to him, offered him a job. And he said, okay, I'm doing nothing with my life. My family couldn't afford to send me to school because his parents were like farmers in a small village in Nepal, and they were not able to send him to school. So he was really struggling. He was a surfer. And my father said, okay, I feel like that job will be a great opportunity where I can help my family get some money. So he said, okay, to that job. But it turned out that the man was a trafficker, and then he sold my dad in India. My dad had no idea where he is, what is the Hindi language is, so he was really confused. He started working in a house as a maid, where the owner used to beat him, locked him inside the toilet, didn't give him food. He used to sleep on the floor in the kitchen with like no blanket, no pillows. So he had a very terrible childhood. Speaking about my mother, she also had a very, very terrible childhood. She grew up in a West Bengal in India. Her mother was working as a maid. She was also couldn't afford to send my mom to school, so they both are like illiterate. My mom started working with my grandmother at the age of 5. And then as she turned older, she started thinking like, you know, I should also make some extra money. So she started working in a different house. But as she grew up, she started facing difficulties with the owner. The owner used to abuse her, sexually harass her. And I remember my mom telling me this story that one day she was really, really anxious about what's going on with her life. She went back home. She talked to my grandmother and said, "Mom, I don't feel safe going to this house and working because the guy's doing this to me." And my grandmother replied that, "Honey, you cannot leave this job. Yeah. Like, we need money. We only way out is to you have to figure out by yourself. I have been dealing this throughout my whole life." So basically, she was like helpless. So that's my like parents' story. Like, they had a very, very traumatic childhood, but they overcome, fought their fight, and met in India, and then they got married there, and I was born. We were struggling really a lot in India. So when, at the age of 9, me and my family moved to Nepal to have a better job opportunities for my parents and a better school wherever we can go. But moving to Nepal is also another challenge, that there was a language barrier, the cultural barrier, starting from the beginning again. So my parents sent me and my brother in a government school in Nepal. It's like a public school, but like way terrible. The teacher most of the time don't show up. Even if they show up, like, they beat you and then abuse you, torture you. And I have like many stories about that. We can go deeper onto that.
No,
later.
We don't have to.
Yes, we can go to later. Yes. And my parents got a room, a small one room where there was like no running water, no heat, no cooling system, nothing. It's like a very, just one little room. My brother and my parents used to live in that one room. 27% people are living under the poverty line. And the education system is the main thing that's like really, really weak. That's like affecting the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
But the great thing happened is like when I was 11 years old, I met Kamlesh. Mm-hmm. My friend, he is. And we used to live in this one neighborhood. We instantly became friends. Then one day he told me that, you know, I have met this woman. She's so amazing. She takes me to these amazing places and, you know, buys me the chocolates and stuff. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. Like, you know, I want that too. And do you think I can also meet that woman? And he was like, let me think about it. But in a couple of weeks later, like he said, like, you know what? My birthday is coming and the woman has offered like me, like, you know, you can invite your friends and we're going to have a huge party in this fancy restaurant in Kathmandu. It's the capital city of Nepal. And that's amazing. I was like, okay, I'm excited for this. I went to school in the morning. I was just keep thinking about this, like, you know, what should I wear? Like, if I don't have any good clothes, this woman might not accept me, not allow me in the fancy restaurant. So I was like really, really nervous. When I was coming back from school, there was like a one white sneakers outside someone's house. I was like, okay, there's nobody. I needed good shoes. I'm just going to borrow it for today. So you can like, of course, guess it. Like, you know, I stole them.
Yeah.
I ran back home. I was so nervous. I have never done this. Like, I've never stole anything. I was so nervous. I went straight back to a bathroom. And then I took out the shoes. I was like nervous. My hands were shaking. I'm sweaty. And then I wore them. And then I realized the shoes were like 2 inches bigger than my feet. I was like, damn it. And then, but I figured out, like, put socks in them and managed to wear them. That night, I went to meet mom, Lauren Yangs, the founder of the Blue Butterfly Foundation. That was the first time I met her. And I didn't know how to speak English that time because, as I said, like, this school was, like, really terrible. They don't teach you anything. So Kamlesh used to help me translate whatever I want to say. But she always encouraged me to, you know, speak and try whatever you can say it and I'll understand. We had a great night on his birthday. Before leaving from that restaurant, she promised me that she will put me into better school and she will sponsor me to go to a boarding school, where I can learn English and many other things. And I was like, wow, that's a great opportunity. I went back home. I talked to my parents. Hey, mom, I just met this American woman. She's so nice. She said she's going to put me into good school. Mm-hmm. And that's a good opportunity. I would like to do that. But my parents said, stop going there. Don't meet with that woman. God knows what she's going to do to you. Mm-hmm. She's going to sell your organs in black market. Like, you have no future. But I was, as a kid, I don't care about my organs. I want to go. I care about the chocolate. So next day I went back, meet. We created a bond. I talked to my parents again. I convinced them. And we had an understanding. And she was like, okay. My parents were like, okay, fine. She can, you know, if she can wants to help, then we are really grateful. And then I moved to this school. It was better than my previous school, but still it was very, very terrible shape. Like, the teacher always abuse you, hit you with stick, torture you. But I have got these opportunities where I have to give my 100% best. And I don't want to fail any classes. I want to, like, keep going to this school. So I stayed up late, taught myself how to read and write in English. And then I started getting good grades. And when I graduated from the high school, I was awarded as the best leader at my high school. So the journey was all because of the mom who is sitting here and the foundation who have helped me to give me a better opportunities in my life and better opportunities through education. So coming back to like the question, like the life in Nepal for like majority people who doesn't have any support is like really, really terrible.
Is the caste system similar to what exists in India? Is it the same levels?
Yes, it's the same. There's the four different levels, and the struggling caste is usually the untouchables, they call, or depressed caste. So that caste still have like, you know, are the minorities, marginalized group who are like struggling, who haven't got the equal representation in the country. Yeah, so that's like, it's similar to India.
You call Lauren mom. Are your parents still in Nepal?
Yes, my parents are still in Nepal and they know each other and they're fine with it.
Yeah.
So in Nepal, we usually, like anybody who is older than us, we call uncle, auntie. And when I met mom, I was really shy. I was a little boy, of course. So she take care of me in such a way that I felt towards her that I should call her mom. She's like my second mom too. So I started calling her mom since I was a kid.
He was the cutest little thing you've ever seen. I mean, he's like really tall now and big, but he was like a peewee little thing and had the sweetest little face. And every time I look at him with that smile, I still see that sweet little face that came to my door the first time when I took him out to dinner that time. And he was so afraid to speak English. And then he would start to come to my place every morning at 5:30 and come, Mom, he called me Mommy Lauren at the time, Mommy Lauren, wake up. And we would go to the monkey temple, which is this Buddhist temple, and it has 365 steps to get up there. And both the boys would come and they would just pull up there, and I'd be like, oh, half dead trying to get up there. And about the school, I want to say that I put him in. I had no idea about the kind of abuse that was going on there. You know, and it was so normalized for the kids that they didn't tell me. So I spoke to the principal just to give you an idea, and they said they're going to treat him so well and all of this stuff. And so, you know, this has been such a learning journey for me as well. But I do want to say, you know, he failed all his classes the first year because he didn't know any English. And again, there was no lighting and nothing, but he stayed up all night and studied and taught himself. And then when I found out about what was going on, I put him into a much better school. At that point, I'd made friends with some academics, and I put him into an excellent school that was progressive that I started. And that's where he really began to thrive.
Sanjay, I have a really important question for you.
Yes.
Did you return the sneakers?
No comments.
So, you know, that was very nice of you, Kamlesh, to invite Sanjay to your birthday celebration. You obviously met Lauren first. So tell me a little bit about your life in Nepal and how Lauren came into it.
Thank you very much. So I was born in India. So I have a younger sister. She's 2 years younger than me. So I moved to Nepal with my parents when I was three. And I come from a very rural village of Nepal, where there is no electricity still, no transportation, no means of health, education. So people walk almost a day to get groceries to the town, so which is the bit like daily lifestyle of that village. So I come from that village. I used to live with my grandparents. They were farmers. My dad and mom, they both were illiterate. None of my family members ever went to school. When I was about five, my dad went to Malaysia because male member of the household goes to the Gulf countries to work because there's no employment opportunities in Nepal, especially when you are illiterate. So he went to Malaysia in working in the glass factory when I was five. And after my dad left, as Nepal is a patriarchal society, there was a huge backlash for my mom, because my grandparents and the society would blame on her character when she engages with other men or like, you know, she communicates with other men, like in terms of work and any kind of situations, she would be questioned for her character and stuff. So it was a very difficult situation. She had to leave the house because of those circumstances. So she locked me and my sister in the room before she left. And my grandparents were working in the field all day. Me and my sister, we were inside the room all day without food or anything. So we were crying. I used to eat dirt, whatever I found on the floor. So my neighbors heard me crying. And so they used to throw food from the window. I come from, talking about the caste, I come from the Untouchables caste. And they have a huge practice of caste system in my village. And they have divided tap systems and everything is divided. And we cannot enter the house of the higher caste people, or we cannot touch the food or water. That would be considered contaminated. So whenever we touch the water or food by accident, they would beat us. There was an incident when I was going to get the water one day. I touched the container of a guy who came from the higher caste, and he spilled all the water because I touched it, and then he slapped me and then asked me to stay in the back of the queue and then fill the water once everybody was done. And I was young. So these were the kind of situation in the village. And one day my uncle came from Kathmandu, which is the capital city, and saw those circumstances. And he and my dad had the communication to bring me to Kathmandu for the better life, better situation. So he took me and my sister to Kathmandu. And when I went there, my stomach started to swell. And my uncle took me to the hospital one day. And a doctor told me that I had roundworms because of eating all this dirt in village. And I was throwing up from my mouth and my nose. And doctor said that I would have died if I hadn't been to the hospital in time, because the worms would go to the brain and lay eggs in my brain. So luckily I was in the hospital on time, and then they gave me medicines, and then I started throwing up, and basically the worms all came out. So yeah, and I started healing slowly. Luckily I got an opportunity to go to the English school because my dad was sending money from Malaysia. We used to live in one room with my uncle and aunt, my cousins, and me and my sister, and we could barely afford the rent. We could barely afford the food and school and everything, because my dad was the only one supporting everybody. And I used to work in the restaurants nearby, like, you know, wash dishes, clean the restaurants, because they would give me some leftovers after. So I used to do that after I come back from school. So there was a program called martial arts in my school. And all of my friends were taking part, and I was very excited. I told my aunt that I also wanted to be part of the program. And she scolded me, and she said, we can barely afford the rent, barely afford food and everything, and you are lucky that you're going to school. Don't come to me from next time asking for this kind of stuff. I was very sad. I cried. So I cried all night. I didn't eat. I was a little stubborn. My dad found out about it, and then I got the opportunity to go to the program. And that's where I met Mom. We used to practice in front of the apartment that she used to live. So we were practicing, and she came with a kid. She was being very playful. She started showing us some yoga kicks, and she was showing her flexibility. And we were like, oh my God, who is this? And our teacher, who was, you know, so he was also shocked. So she asked us, everybody, to guess where she was from. And I had this concept that all white people are from United States, are from America. So because I used to, like, you know, grow up watching in the movies and everything, like all white people from America. And I thought, she's white, she's definitely from America. So I said, America. So I was in the back because I didn't have the uniform, because they put in according to the rank. And she asked, oh, who is that? So I said, it's me. And then she called me in front, and she asked, do you know where from America I am? And I said, I only knew New York, you know, famous Spider-Man and everything. So, yeah, from New York. And she was like, oh, you seem very smart. What's your name? So I introduced myself. I said, and she asked, like, where I lived. And I said, I lived nearby the place. And I told her that I would take care of that kid because he was a little shy. I would help him come and go. We will live together. And one day, she invited me to her apartment. And when she went inside, I saw on the floor there were candies and cookies, all the food that she would distribute to the kids on the street. So when she went inside, that I tried to put put everything in my pocket as much as possible. Yeah. Unfortunately, I wasn't wearing, like, the box pants. They would have more pockets. But anyways, she came outside. She asked about me, my background, my families, and I told her everything, where my dad is, where my mom. I told her that I don't live with my parents. Mm-hmm. She also shared her story about her stepdaughter, everything that happened the previous year. It was a very emotional connection, I would say. It was very, it felt deep. I think I cried. I think she was also very emotional at the time. And I told her that I am very unlucky growing up. And she said, you are not unlucky. Sometimes kids get mixed up in the wrong tummy. So you can start calling me mommy. So that was a rhyming tummy, mommy. So, yeah.
How old were you then?
I was 11. Hmm. Yeah, I was 11 years old. And so my birthday was coming near, and she said that she would throw a big birthday party for me in a fancy restaurant where, like, all the tourists, they go there, like, you know, it's the tourist area. Right. And I was very excited. I had never been to the restaurant in my life. I had only cleaned the restaurants. So she asked me to invite my friends and everybody that I knew. So that's when I invited Sanjay. We went there. And we had so much food, and that was the first time we ate pizza, varieties of food. Hmm. Yes, so it was awesome. And then my school fees were due from, I think, 2 to 3 months, and she paid the tuition fees, and she bought some new uniforms and notebooks and all the books, necessary supplies for school, and before she left. And she kept, every year she used to come and visit. On seventh grade, I had to move to a different place called Chitwan, and I got into addiction. I started smoking, drinking, and started doing the pills, like, you know, tablets. Mm-hmm. So for, I think, almost for 2 years, I almost died because of that. But when mom came 1 year and then she saw me in that situation, she was like, I think something is wrong. I didn't tell her exactly that I was into addiction, but I think she knew it. So she reminded me that don't forget that we have to go to America one day. Mm. And don't forget that your future is bright. And always remember. So I think it's the hope, you know. So you asked the question about how's life in Nepal. I would say hopeless. Mm. The poverty, I think the government is corrupt, and it's just the situation is hopeless, I would say. So I think she came as a hope in our lives, and I got out of the addiction, and I continued studying. I completed my high schools with good grades, and COVID lockdown happened, and during that time we started preparing for our planning to come here. Mm-hmm. And so that's when we like really worked, because we were in the house, we were locked down inside, and we read, we studied, we practiced, and we applied for the colleges, and then we practiced for our interview. And there's only one embassy in Nepal. So we applied from India. So we went there, Sanjay and I, we both went to India. We stayed there for a month, and that's the deciding time. Mm-hmm. For the futures, because one interview would decide the whole situation. So it was very stressful. I felt like I couldn't sleep the day before the interview. Mm-hmm. And then I called mom the night before, and we did some yoga, breathing. Mm-hmm. And all this. It was, yeah. So, and then we applied for college, and then we got here, and yes, that's how I met her.
And so here is SUNY New Paltz, where you're both studying. Mm-hmm. And so are you here on student visas?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Does that concern you, considering the current political climate?
It definitely does, because the current administration is, so he's targeting all the immigrants. Doesn't matter if they have visas, if they don't, even if they don't. So they don't play according to the rules. And even though we say that we have the visa, we are under the student visa, we are always under the threat of the ICE showing up and then deporting us. And we don't have any clue where they are going to deport us if that happened. So it's constant fear of getting deported.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Lauren Yanks, founder and executive director of the Blue Butterfly Foundation, along with Kamlesh Baral and Sanjay Basnet, right after this.
3 years ago, Iranian police arrested a young woman for not wearing her hijab in public. She died in custody. Today, thousands of women across the country are openly defying the law despite the risks.
This new generation realized that there is no way to reform this regime, and they decided to leave whatever they want. They are more brave than us, and they are paying for the expenses.
That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Families are going hungry. Local food pantries need your help. Donate non-perishable food or volunteer your time. Visit WJFFradio.org to learn how you can make a difference. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
Welcome back to CatsCast. I'm here with Lauren Yanks, founder and executive director of the Blue Butterfly Foundation, Kamlesh Baral, president of the Student Association at SUNY New Paltz, and Sanjay Basnet, Chief Justice of the Student Association at SUNY New Paltz. Lauren, tell me a little bit about the involvement of the foundation to get these guys here. And are you working with other students? How do you even begin to decide who of these thousands of kids who are living in such horrendous conditions you have the resources to help?
Oh, that's such a good question, and heartbreaking. I'm mommy to I would say hundreds and hundreds of kids in Nepal when I lived there for a couple of years, and still when I go back, my friend said the other day, I'm Jewish. There's something called Beshert, you know, it's a soulmate kind of thing. I'm so close to so many kids and people over there, but there's some that are just in your soul. And these two little boys, certainly, you know, for whatever reason, it's a deep, deep connection. They're my sons. And I brought over two more boys who are now in Boston. I have many daughters over there, but it's much harder to bring the girls over because their lives are so much harder. It took me forever, but I finally got my daughter Kabita over, who I met even before I met these boys. She was trafficked. She was raped at 5 years old by a man in her little slum neighborhood where she lived with lepers and everything. And now she's at UAlbany studying. Also, they really wanted it, you know, and I think that they could make it in America. You know, it's not easy once you get here. It's tough, and I've tried to really instill that in them. You know, everyone thinks they're going to come to America and the streets are paved with gold, or they used to think that, right? And I let them know, no, it's tough going. You're going to have to work harder than you ever have before at school, everything else. These were also kids that I felt could really make it in America, that they would be the future leaders. And both Kamlesh and Sanjay want to be human rights lawyers and go back and help kids like themselves. Sanjay wants to get very involved in education there and enhance the education. Kamlesh wants to be prime minister of Nepal, and I would not bet against him. I think he's going to be. And Kabita will stay here and take over, I think, the Blue Butterfly from me after I, like, just finally truly drop that because it's exhausting. As far as the resources, you know, I beg, borrow, and steal. We're doing a campaign now to raise funds for them. It's by far the part that I absolutely hate the most. Like, I have a beautiful support, a beautiful community of wonderful people who've supported me in this and put on fundraisers and really help and have taken the kids in as their own. They have a lot of aunts and uncles here. But, like, for me, it's second nature to be able to go into a trafficked orphanage in Nepal and find 40 kids lying on the floor, malnourished, in their own feces, being run by the mob and being trafficked and paid for as having been stolen from God knows where. And I can go in and take over, face down the mob, you know, and completely revamp it. That to me is second nature. I can go in and do that. But what I'm so uncomfortable with is telling other people about the work that I've done and asking for help and support, even though it's not about me. I'm the conduit. I'm just the one doing it. I'm asking support for the kids. It's all volunteer. It's all in honor of Zoe's life. I don't make a cent from this. And we definitely need help. Since Trump has come in, we've lost some of our funding because of all the horrible stuff that's been going on. And so if truly honest, I think it's been devastating for me over the last, how long has it been now? 20 years that he's been in office, but 6 months maybe. and it's been, it's affected all our mental health. And I tell this story. That's so sweet because Sanjay really keeps his emotions very close to the chest. You know, he doesn't share a lot. And he actually cried to me about a month ago. And it was very, very meaningful for me. We had a very deep conversation. And he said that he felt Trump was getting in the way of our little happy home because I was stressed out. We're all stressed out. And so I made him a promise that we would keep the stress outside of the house, that I would I've started to go see a therapist to help with the stress, and I have a lot of friends who come and I meet with, and I work all that out. And then in our home, it's not allowed to be brought up. We eat, we watch movies, we laugh, we dance, we have friends over, and we keep our home a place of joy. But that doesn't mean that we all haven't been very anxious and really feeling the crunch. And so a few friends of mine are putting on a fundraiser in the beginning of December, and we ask anyone who would like to help in this endeavor. We're desperate, not just for these kids that are here, but I also still continue to support many kids in Nepal. I started a bunch of schools there who are trafficked or very vulnerable to being trafficked, and they can go to our website, bluebutterflyfoundation.org. If they want to know more, they can call me. My phone number is on there. Or if anyone wants to get involved, we can use all the help that we can get. And if I could just say how amazing these kids are, these immigrants who are so dangerous, these boys leave at 8 a.m. They're here all day. They study. They don't get home until midnight. They're getting straight A's. Kamlesh was like the underdog and ran for president of the student association, and no one knew who he was, and he worked night and day, and he won, and he's doing an amazing job. He's president. And Sanjay is become chief justice of the student association. I mean, as Lin-Manuel Miranda said, that great prophet, immigrants, they get the job done. No one works harder than they do. They are my role models. I could not be more proud. And Kabita, too. Kabita is also amazing and works so hard. They never miss a class. And they work jobs at the schools. I mean, I know I'm just kvelling, as we say in Yiddish, but these are the best of humanity, not just the best of immigrants, the best of humanity. And we'd love to have anyone over for Nepalese food if they would like to meet us. And our doors are always open.
Thank you. Sanjay and Kamlesh, what has been your experience here?
When I moved to Newport, again, it's another different challenge. It's a bigger college now. I came as a transfer student here in the spring of 2024. A little difficult than the Ulster, going to Ulster, definitely. Now I'm in the, I feel like I'm in the big league now. So I'm taking my major classes. I'm a history major, by the way. And then again, starting from new college, new system, new way of doing like work and getting involved. The first thing I did was join student government again. I became a senior student senator. The life has been challenging, but at the same time, blessing too. Blessing through hard work, understanding what has given to me is something that a lot of people not get it. Mm-hmm. But I have to really, really like appreciate this and be grateful every single day and work what I have. You know, every morning, that's mom said, like, we wake up with the optimistic mind and with, like, you know, we have to give our best because this is the only chance we have right now. So, yeah, that's something that my process of doing, dealing with it every day.
Kamlesh, how often do you think back on where you've come from and how far you've gotten?
When I came here for the first time, I felt like I time traveled almost 100 years because of the gap and everything. The first few semester was difficult, but I overcame the situation, and moving to SUNY Ulster was better because it was a great transition for us. It was a small campus, and we were able to connect with the professors and friends and the staff, faculties, everyone. So, and they were helpful. The resources were much more available. And once I started getting adjusted with the environment and getting comfortable with the people and and friends and professors there. I ran for the president in the student government, and I won. And it was a great experience to be in that leadership role. I went there, represented to different formal and informal meetings, went to the SUNY conferences in different places. So it was awesome. And that's how I met President Wheeler, actually.
Mm. President of SUNY New Paltz.
Yes, president of SUNY New Paltz. I was in the conference for the foundation of SUNY Ulster, and we were in the same table.
Mm.
Yeah, and I didn't know that he was the president of SUNY New Paltz. And then we had the whole conversation, and he asked me, what do you think of SUNY New Paltz? And I said, I have heard about it. Yeah, I live close to SUNY New Paltz. So he said, I think you should transfer to SUNY New Paltz. It's a great campus. So I felt very warm energy from him, and that's how we ended up to SUNY New Paltz. And coming to SUNY New Paltz was also better experience in terms of, like, you know, getting better education and getting challenged. So first year, it was just normal trying to get adjusted to the system and everything. And then I thought that I should run for the president of the student association again. It was a tough competition, but I went person-to-person campaigning. It was shocking that I won, I couldn't believe. And it has been a little stressful, but as they say, like, great power comes with great responsibilities. So, yeah, it's been great.
You know, coming here, learning the language, learning, you know, really starting from square one, and then saying I want to be the student government president. That's really brave, and I, you know, I get a sense of that bravery from day one when you called from the back row of your school in Nepal and said, well, you're from America.
Yeah.
You're from New York, and that's look how far that that's getting you. Persistence, bravery, and a lot of hard work. I'm so impressed by both of you, all three of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Lauren, where's the greatest need for your organization when you have these fundraisers or do what you hate to do, which is to ask for money, but if that money comes in, where does it go? What resources do you need to keep all this going? What does it take?
You know, it goes for their education, for our living expenses, for Kabita as well, and as well as, I would say, I still take care of about a couple hundred kids in Nepal. What's happening in Nepal, the glaciers are melting on the Himalayas. It's melting and polluting the water below, the water supply below. So what was potable, so people who've subsisted in agriculture for, you know, thousands of years can no longer live there, and with the global economy. So what these people are doing is they're moving to Kathmandu and the other cities, and they live in these quote-unquote slum neighborhoods, and they're very, very vulnerable to being trafficked. They're seen as backwards. They speak sort of their local tongue. And so in a couple of these neighborhoods, I've built schools there so that these kids can have a chance. So every month I'm sending money there, and then I'm paying the bills for these kids here. It's all on, in all honesty, it all falls on me and the Blue Butterfly, mm-hmm. Yeah, the foundation. And what is needed, we live without much of anything, as slim as possible. I wear the same clothes every day.
They're very nice, by the way.
Thank you. One pair. And, you know, the boys start packing their lunch, so they eat here. So I would say we have a budget of $100,000 a year that goes, I would say, half to Nepal and half here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've had grants that have been wonderfully helpful. But since this administration has come in, two of the grants that we depend on have dried up.
Mm.
So, so I haven't been sleeping well at night, if I'm honest. And so I just have to get better at saying, I need help, not for me. These kids need help. You know, we're all one human family, and we all have to carry each other. And by the way, these kids over there are making our clothes, our computers, the global economy. We all have blood on our hands. So I would say not only is this an act of compassion to help these kids, actually, we all owe it. We're living cheaply here, say at Walmart, for very specific reasons, you know, and it has to do with a lot of child labor and slave labor and people living in horrible conditions. And I'm trying to create a better balance. So anyone who cares about that and create a more equitable world, please help us. Yeah.
The website is bluebutterflyfoundation.org.
Yes.
And this has been a wonderful conversation. I've just met you, Kamlesh and Sanjay, but I'm already so proud of you.
Thank you so much.
You've achieved a lot. And we're really proud to have you here in our area, and wishing you the best of luck. So, Lauren, Kamlesh, Sanjay, thank you so much for joining us.
We can't thank you enough. This has been such a great honor, and you're such a wonderful guy, Brett, and thank you. We feel very blessed. Do you guys?
Yes, know? Thank you so much, Brett, for connecting us and then inviting us to this radio show.
Yeah.
And it's a great opportunity. Thank you so much for listening our story. It's a blessing. We are grateful.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much. It's for opening the heart, first of all, and letting us share our stories and also hearing our stories. It's been an honor. Thank you for everyone who is listening as well. Thank you.
If I could just say one last thing, that these kids are not just hard workers or get ahead. They're also the most compassionate, kind, thoughtful, funny, beautiful human beings with like deep souls who really understand what life is. Their maturity level, it's been overwhelming that I can't find the words to have seen them blossom. It's the greatest blessing, and I hope that everybody gets a chance to meet them and know them, because they make us all better.
And Sanjay, both of you need to, go back when you've finished your studies and fulfill those aspirations, so you can actually be at the forefront of turning Nepal around in a really positive way, so that hope will return, right?
Yes, definitely.
You say it's a hopeless situation, Kamlesh, but you hope to be the prime minister there one day, so I think there's some hope deep down.
Yes, me too. I think it's my ultimate goal is to become the prime minister, because the whole government is corrupt. So I think it's important to be politically active and be the change. At least try to be the change.
Will you remember me when you're prime minister so I can get a really great VIP tour?
Yes, when you come to Nepal, there will be a red carpet.
It's fantastic.
Yes.
I'll hold you to it.
Yes.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Cat's Cast is a production of Silver Hollow Audio, Saturdays on Radio Catskill, and online at catscast.com, home of the original podcast, with a full episode archive, transcripts, and more. I'm Brett Barry. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's oldest independent community bank, offering deposit and loan products for more than 110 years. Members FDIC and Equal Housing Lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. More information at jeff.bank. And from the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, dedicated to promoting the Sullivan County Catskills. SullivanCatskills.com. And from listeners like you.
The Radio Catskill Music Auction is live. Bid on rare vinyl records, once-in-a-lifetime music performances, awesome electronics, and more. Get your hands on these incredible items and experiences at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Jeff. Join me Saturday at midnight for Electric Mountain. 2 hours of house, techno, indie dance, and more, plus sets by top local, New York City, and global guest DJs. From the underground to the highest peak, it's Electric Mountain, Saturday at midnight on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.